Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Council of Elrond, your favorite Lord of the Rings and Tolkien podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Dave, and today we're going to continue our mini-series on the Great Rings of Power. We've already covered the three Elven and the seven Dwarven rings, so now it's the turn of the Nine. We will talk all about the Nine rings given to mortal men doomed to die. We'll discuss the effects this had on these men and how they became the famous Ringwraiths and all their strengths and weaknesses.
And nine rings were gifted to the race of men who above all else desire power.
So before we get into today's episode, I would love to remind you guys to please share, subscribe to the podcast, go check out our YouTube channel called The Melonheads with two L's. And that's where you can see me and Dave hashing out these topics live and in bite-sized chunks. Also check out our Patreon page where we provide extra Melonhead chats and musings along with our full-length videos and other good stuff. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if it makes you giggle, please, please tell a friend about it. It doesn't need to be a public display on social media of love for us or anything. It could just be talking to a friend and saying, oh, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I think you might like it or something like that. So we would really, really appreciate that. And thank you to everyone that already is doing it and who's passing the pod and growing our little podcast. It's really good. We've got more and more people listening every day. So that's really exciting. So yeah. Anyway, thanks so much for the love and support already. We love you all and hopefully not like Eowyn's love for Aragorn, which is not reciprocated. So
yeah, and like we do need you guys to spread this to as many friends as possible because, you know, our list of allies grows thin. So we need to expand the horizons as much as we can.
Exactly. And we'll try and get a little Lord of the Rings quote for every situation, just for these particular moments. So thank you for that one, Dave.
And Saruman, you tell me, has betrayed us. Our list of allies grows thin.
So let's start with another quick reminder, Dave, of where these rings came from. So can you remind our listeners and can you remind yourself on what was the origin of these nine rings? How did they first come to be?
So the nine rings, along with the other 20, I don't know, I'm getting confused here, but
Celebrimbor, there's 20 in total, so there's not 9 plus 16, that's too many.
Yeah, no, sorry, I was trying to think of backtrack here. So Sauron, as sneaky Annatar, goes to befriend the lovely Celebrimbor, who we're going to see in the new TV show.
Very good.
Who's got short hair. he was tricked into creating all these rings, and Annatar was basically asking Celebrimbor to smith these rings for him and give out to all of his friends. And Celebrimbor was like, yeah, sure, why not? And he made some for, well, he just made them all for Sauron, and none of them were going to be as powerful as the ring that Sauron planned to forge himself. So they were like, what's the term that's used for these rings? They're like lesser rings, isn't that what they're called?
No, these are rings of power. They're not. Rings as well, but these are rings of power. Like as far as Celebrimbor was concerned, these were the most powerful rings. He didn't know about Sauron's plan to make like the Master Ring. He was just making these big rings of power, which were going to be really helpful for, you know, giving certain powers that we've discussed in previous podcasts and that we're going to discuss today. But thank you for that.
So the lesser rings were before the rings of power.
Lesser rings were like kind of like, yeah, they were like the as you said, the practice rings, like the beta level kind of rings.
Elisar rings.
Elisar rings. Very nice. Their origin is the same as the Dwarven rings, which we spoke about in last week's episode. And so they were made by Celebrimbor and Sauron in Eregion around 1500 of the Second Age is the year that was done. So, the fact that Sauron was involved and he was hands-on means that he could put much more of his influence into these rings compared to the three Elven rings, which we also discussed a couple of weeks back. So that was around 1500 of Second Age. 100 years later, 1600, Sauron completed his own One Ring in Mordor. And then nearly 100 years later after that, 1697, so 97 years later, Sauron comes back and attacks Eregion. And he basically sacks the realm and he claims the 7 dwarven rings and the 9 other rings. So he's like calling them dwarven rings and 9 men rings just to separate them. But at the time, it was just 16 rings.
They were just rings, yeah.
He collected them and he tortured Celebrimbor for the information on the rings. And he also, and so Celebrimbor gave him these rings, but he never gave up the location of the 3 elven rings, which he had sent away. And where had he sent them, Dave?
You mean to who? To whom?
To whom had he sent the 3 elven rings?
Oh, man. He sent one to Círdan, right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yeah, okay. One to Galadriel.
Good.
And one to... Elrond.
Elrond ended up with one, but who did he send it to? Who gave it to Elrond? It was someone kind of important who we're going to see in the show as well. We're going to see in the Rings of Power. The big G.
Oh, Gil-galad, the High King.
Very good, the High King, Gil-galad. Yeah. So if anyone's seen the trailers for the Rings of Power series, Gil-galad is the guy that's all clad in gold. He is the High King. And now you said he sent one to Círdan. He didn't actually send one to Círdan. He sent 2 to Gil-galad. And then Gil-galad gave his to Círdan. And he held on to one himself. Later, Círdan gives his one to Gandalf. And Gil-galad gives his other one to Elrond. And that's where they end up.
So that's the Ring of Fire is that one. The one that Círdan passes to
The one
to
that Círdan
Gandalf,
gives
right?
to Gandalf is the Ring of Fire. Yeah. Correct. So we spoke about those a few weeks ago. But again, it's difficult to remember this stuff. So no worries about that. So that's where they ended up. And then Sauron takes the 9 rings. The 16 rings. And of the 16, he gives 9 of them to these 9 kings of men. And they give these men powers and strengths and influence over others. And they also give them, like Sméagol, unnatural long life. And these rulers go on to become powerful warriors and kings and sorcerers. Now, the rings also have the perfect effect, which cannot be said for the other rings Sauron helped to make, meaning that they were like a drug to the bearer and they loved them and they eventually became enslaved entirely to the will of these rings. And then in turn to the will of the One Ring. So that was, Sauron was pretty happy with that because the same thing didn't happen with the 7.
Yeah, so these 9 rings, they're kind of the only ones that we know about that worked exactly how Sauron created them to work. Because we talked about the previous ones where the dwarves, they just kind of become more greedy and the elves are,
The elves' rings were not made by Sauron's hand. So they were a little bit separate, but the 7 dwarven rings, I think basically just, we spoke about it already last week, but they were, the dwarves just turned out to be a little bit like hardier than Sauron had expected, I suppose. But
it kind of helped out Sauron it helped Sauron out in a secondary where they were distracted and they were also getting killed off by dragons and
did work out. Yeah, it probably it was a bit of a mini win for him.
Directly, the 9 rings for the men, they worked exactly.
Now, again, of course,
plan.
If Sauron's plan had worked and if the 7 had worked the way that they were intended to, he would have had like 9 ring wraiths and then 7 dwarven ring wraiths, which would have been really cool to see as well.
I mean, that would have been cool.
That would have been deadly. Anyway, let's get back on track. So over the centuries, the 9 men prospered as their power and wealth and mortal lifespans extended under the corrupting influence of their rings. And as time wore on, their mortal bodies began to decay and fade, and they started becoming more and more part of the Wraith world. And then they kind of began to spend time kind of in both worlds, and they could see things that were unseen, and they lived in both worlds for a little while. But then eventually they just completely slipped into the shadow world and became Nazgul or Ringwraiths, and they were just enslaved entirely to Sauron's will. And just in case anyone's unsure, Nazgul is just the translation for Ringwraiths in Black Speech. So that's where, if you're thinking, what's the difference? Well, Ringwraith is a Nazgul. It's just a different language for it. So
cool.
In the Second Age, in the year 2251, so that's around 550 years after they got the rings from Sauron, the Nazgul first appeared in Middle-earth. That's the first sighting we get of them. But we don't get told much else about their actions or anything that they did. And we don't really hear about them up until the end of the Second Age, which is the year 3441. So that's a long time later. And that's the end of the end of the Second Age when Sauron gets defeated in the War of the Last Alliance. And then we hear that they fade into the shadows and they kind of just they're again not heard of until 1,000 or so years later when Sauron comes back. So then the year 1300 of the Third Age, so again 1300 years later, Sauron's back with a bang, back in black.
Back with a vengeance. And the return of Sauron to Electric Boogaloo.
And he kind of just sets up shop in Dol Guldur, and the Ringwraiths return then as well. And the leader of the Ringwraiths heads up north, and he gathers all these evil men, and they found the Witch Kingdom of Angmar. And that gives the Lord of the Nazgul his famous moniker of the Witch King of Angmar. So that's all we kind of hear about them up to that point. But who were these nine men? Do you have any idea who these guys were, Dave?
I think that there isn't really any information on them, but I do remember looking up this very question ages ago, and there was one that stuck out. I think there might have been like two or three other theories, but one of them was an Easterling. What's theorized is one, our hypothesis.
No, you're an Easterling. You're correct. Now, so I'll get to that in a second, but yeah, very good. Well done. Mm-hmm. So basically, we don't have a lot of information at all on these men, and we actually don't know anything about who they were before Sauron gave them the rings, apart from assuming that they were men who held high positions of power and rank in the world of men. And we know that three were lords of Numenor and one was an Easterling.
Okay.
Now, only two are ever given titles or names. And the first one is the one that we've already mentioned, which is the most famous and the most powerful of the nine, the Witch King of Angmar, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. the Lord of the Nazgul. And he was the leader of the Ringwraiths, and he was Sauron's second in command in the Second and the Third Ages. So we know that he was once a mortal king of men until he was corrupted by one of the Nine Rings of Power, becoming an undying wraith in the service of Sauron. After Sauron's defeat by the Last Alliance, he eventually reappeared and founded the evil realm of Angmar, where he gained the title the Witch King, and he ruled for almost seven centuries until the kingdom of Arnor was conquered. The Witch King returned to Mordor to facilitate Sauron's return to power, and then took Gondor city of Minas Ithil and refortified it as Minas Morgul, which we've also covered in our Minas Tirith episode. And he snuffed out the line of kings of Gondor. He led Sauron's armies in the War of the Ring. He stabbed Frodo Baggins on Weathertop during the first months of Frodo's venture out of the Shire. And at the Battle of Pelennor Fields, he broke the Great Gate of Minas Tirith, killed King Théoden, and he met his own fate or his own demise as well. So that's everything we know really about. Well, there's more things we know about the Witch King, but that's a quick little summary of who he is. The second guy I'm going to mention is the guy that you alluded to a moment ago, which was the only other guy who was actually given a name at all. And his name was Camul the Easterling. So he was originally an Easterling who ruled in Rûn, which you can see on the map is way down the south. Well, southeast, I suppose, as well. Like south as in it's below Mordor, and Mordor's in the east. And hence Easterling, I suppose. And during the Third Age, he was a lieutenant of Sauron, and he held Dol Guldur as his domain. And he was the Witch King's second in command, and he actually became the leader of the Nazgul for a short time after the Witch King was killed. Because remember, the Witch King was killed at the Battle of Minas Tirith, and then the battle at the Black Gate didn't happen for another couple of months or so. So during that time, this guy, Camul the Easterling, he became the leader of the Nazgul. So he led the Nazgul to the Battle of the Black Gate, riding his fell beast. And that was before they were attacked by the Eagles. And the Nazgul retreated when Sauron sent Frodo put on the ring. And then they were quickly sent to Mount Doom, where he basically ended up dying in the fires of Mount Doom after the eruption. And he is the wraith that we see chase Frodo and the hobbits to Buckleberry Ferry, and who spoke to Farmer Maggot asking for Baggins. And the other thing I was going to say about Camul is that he held other titles such as the Shadow of the East, the Second Chief, and the Black Easterling. So that's him.
Yeah. I didn't know that there was... I kind of assumed that it was always the Witch King that was the one... That was hunting down Frodo in all those bits where he's going to the Shire and he's chasing the hobbits to Buckleberry Ferry.
Yeah. I mean, most people would assume that, but and again, I didn't know that until I was kind of researching this, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. That's cool. This Camul guy.
Camul.
Camul.
Do you remember actually?
Camel, I don't know.
Camelot. Camelot.
Camulot.
Yeah, isn't it like K-H-A-M? That kind of spelling? K-H-A-M-U-L.
U-U-L and U with one of those little like triangular things on top.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of those things for like rune as well.
Which I'm just going to assume is pronounced more like a ooh sound.
Camul. Yeah.
Otherwise, it might be just camel.
Do you remember in that?
I'm basing this on absolutely nothing. I'm just kind of going, probably Kabul sounds.
Yeah, whenever you see there's like some sort of dot or accent or something over a letter, I would just like extend it and be like, ool, rather than Kamul.
Exactly.
Do you remember in the Hobbit movie, I can't remember if it's an extended scene or not, but when Elrond and Galadriel are fighting, Elrond, Galadriel and Gandalf are fighting the Nazgul, and you see them in their forms. Yeah, and one of them does look like an Easterling. I've always remembered that.
That's right.
Which is really cool.
Dressed just like an Easterling garb that like Peter Jackson had. Yeah,
exactly. Here he's got the kind of weird crowned horn things. Mm. But I would like to watch that scene again, slow down or pause it and try just and look at the other Easterlings. And just to see, well, not the other just Nazgul, him, maybe. But like, sorry, yeah, see the other Nazgul and see what Peter Jackson's vision for the others were. Because
of course,
it'd be cool to see if there was like a, you know, one or two Gondorians there. And
well, what I was going to say,
Numenor.
What I was going to go on to say now was that basically that's all the information we really have on these guys. So I was going to maybe do a bit of speculating and just other things that I found online was where we have seen other people coming up with some ideas of who these guys could have been. And so I took a note, a couple of things that's that I saw that were cool, which were, for example, in the game Shadow of Wars, which I don't have. We've both played Shadow of Mordor, but Shadow of Wars is the second one, I think.
Oh, Shadow of War. Yeah. Just Shadow of War, isn't it?
I don't know. It could be Shadow of War.
It's
Shadow
the second one. I've played it, yeah.
Have you played it? All right, okay.
Yeah, I have it. It's good.
Oh, I only have Shadow of Mordor. So in that one, we get a couple of people, but in this one, Shadow of War, there's apparently more kind of fleshed out characters for some of these guys as well. So I'm just going to give you guys a couple of their ideas for this game. Now, remember, this is not a canon. This is not Tolkien's work. This is just, this is just for a bit of fun. So there was the first one that was called the King of Rohan, and he was the ninth King of Rohan, and he was attacked and left to die by assassins. But Sauron found him and gifted him a ring of power. Then the king slaughtered everyone, even his own daughter, who was kidnapped by the assassins, and this caused him to turn into a ringwraith. And there was also a statue of him when you enter Helm's Deep. There was a statue of this king there, but he became a ringwraith, apparently. And the next one is this guy called the Numerian King of Harad. And he was in a war against Sauron, and he marched up to Barad-dûr, and Sauron surrendered to him and offered him a ring of power, which he accepted. And then he eventually became a ringwraith as well. And this is also apparently one of the reasons why the kingdom of Harad was allied to Mordor, because one of the kings was in Sauron's service. Then the next one is the Nazgul sisters, they are called. And these were sisters who were sent by their father to fight Mordor. And after defeating two of the Nazguls, they took the rings for themselves. And then they became corrupted by them. And soon they overthrew their father, their emperor, and they claimed the kingdom for themselves. So that was kind of cool Then the last one is Talion the Ranger of the Black Gate, who I know from the first PlayStation game of this, which is just called Shadow of Mordor. And it just says there's not much known about him, but he was one of the last Nazguls to join the Nine. So again, he just kind of became a wraith. And we kind of see Celebrimbor as a kind of a half wraith as well in that same game. So again, that's just something that we saw from a game that was also maybe talking about possibly the wraiths. Not canon, but just kind of something fun to talk about as well and to think about rates.
And like I definitely need to play that game because I think I played the first maybe hour or two of it, of the sequel Shadow of War, and it was good, like, but I just never got time to go back in it. But maybe now that I'm free from college and all I have to do is podcast stuff, maybe I can give that game a second go,
give it a whirl, give it a go. For sure. Cool. So then, quick question, Dave. Where are the rings of the nine Nazgul? Do they wear them at all times? Are they invisible on their fingers? Do they have fingers? Where? What's the location of the rings?
Good question. I would assume that every single one of them is wearing them on their fingers. They do have fingers, and we see it in Peter Jackson's movies when Frodo goes into the Wraith world. You can see them with their fingers. And also, there is that scene where the Nazgul, or sorry, the Witch King, I believe it is, he's kind of like calling the ring from Frodo to him. And it, the way he's doing it, he's not like outstretching his hand. It's almost like he's putting out his own index
finger.
He's
doing like this.
Yeah, he's doing that. And it's like as if he's got a ring on it and he's using it as a magnet
to suck Frodo's ring before he stabs him at Weathertop.
Exactly, yeah. And he's kind of, I think at first he's kind of stretching out his hand. He's like calling it, but then he's like,
I've always seen that as well in the movie and been like, what kind of a weird grabbing technique is that, Witch King? You don't seem to know how to use your fingers.
It's kind of like a sucking mechanism. It's like
a fist bump.
Yeah.
But like maybe his ring's just a giant magnet that he's trying to like.
It's almost like the power of the ring. He's like trying to draw the ring with his own ring, which kind of, you know, I've never said.
You should be drawing it with a pencil.
We should draw swords together.
Yeah, it's like, the hour that we draw rings.
I've never thought about, or I've never spoken these words out loud, but it's like always a subliminal thing when I'm watching that scene. I'm kind of thinking about that's what he's doing with his ring.
I've had similar thoughts. We're both idiots.
Yeah, that's true. speak for myself. I don't know. That would be my guess.
It's a good kind of way of thinking of things, and you are correct to think that in that scene in the movies we get that. Now I'll cover that in a moment, but the first thing I'm going to say is that Gandalf says in the Fellowship of the Ring, the chapter, the Council of Elrond, quote, "The nine the Nazgul keep." And so. That's a quote from Gandalf, so that would lead us to presume that the ringwraiths possess their rings and they wear them at all times. However, there is a bit of debate about this question in the Tolkien world, and in a letter, number 246, that Tolkien writes of the Nazgul, he says that, quote, "Sauron, who still through their nine rings, which he held, had primary control of their wills." So that seems to say that Sauron held the rings of the nine, which is a bit strange. And most people actually would agree that Gandalf was in fact wrong in his assumption that the nine kept their rings and that Gandalf was just kind of presuming in this moment and he didn't actually get that information from a reliable source. And so...
well, that's cool. It's
yeah.
Like an unreliable narrator thing, kind of like Game of Thrones has going on in their books.
Sure. Or
Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah. And the Lord of the Rings to an extent, like the Silmarillion's kind of just, you know, a lot of it's in the perspective of the elves and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
I mean, yeah.
From a certain point of view.
So one hint that we get is when Frodo encounters the guys at Weathertop. And as you said, you can see the rings on their fingers. Now, that's completely not the case. In the book, they specify that Frodo didn't see any rings on their finger. And so that's quite strange, even because Frodo is a ring bearer. And we saw that with Galadriel, when we spoke about that a couple of weeks ago, he was able to see the ring on her finger, even though he was with Sam and Sam couldn't see the ring on her finger. He just said like he saw a light, like a star when she held up her hand. So he couldn't see the ring. And Frodo was like, "Oh, you're wearing a ring." And she was like, "Oh, can you see it?" And all this. It was like, because he was a ring bearer and he had seen Sauron's eye, he was able to spot these rings. So he would have seen them at Weathertop if they were wearing them. So that's one thing where we would say, oh, it's probably the case. Now, the general consensus and what I believe is that Sauron took back the nine rings and that he now keeps them in his, well, not now, but he kept them in his possession. And the ringwraiths would have already spent enough time wearing them, like maybe over like a couple of thousand years, so that they would have been completely under their influence. Like think of Gollum, he held the ring for 500 years, then lost it and was still under its influence for years and years. So they wouldn't have needed to keep their rings on in order to be under their influence. And perhaps Sauron, without his one ring, felt that he could control them even more by wearing the nine rings on his nine fingers. And use them almost like a remote control for these nine wraiths. So
like he's puppeteering them there. Each ring is like making one do a different action.
Exactly. Cool. So remember that Gollum tells us that he saw Sauron in his new form and that he says that he only had 9 fingers. So maybe Sauron just, you know, on each of his fingers, like some, some, I don't know, crazy gypsy, tarot card reader was just wearing a ring on every finger. So
he's like Captain Jack Sparrow or something.
Yeah.
I do think that's cool, however, that Sauron, or, well, this theory that you're bringing along, or maybe this fact, I don't know,
no,
that Sauron has
I'm
kept...
I'm supposed to theory more.
Yeah, that he's keeping them all in his tower, and it's kind of almost another way of showing how all the Nazgul are slaves to him, and, you know, he's got the one thing that they've, you know, given their lives to, like they've basically dedicated their lives to whatever ring of power that they possess. And now their master has it all locked away and he's telling them what to do and they have no power over themselves or anything else. It's like, the only thing that I have going for me is this ring and my master has that. So I better do what he says or else
exactly,
I won't get to touch it again. So it's just
another thing. Don't even know when if this is the case, if he took the rings, we don't know if that would have like changed their level of power or anything really. We're not really sure. Mm. But we do, like, so basically when Sauron had the one ring, it would have been powerful enough to dominate all the other rings without any doubt at all times. Yeah. And it was just much more efficient. So he wouldn't have any worries about like his Nazgul being, you know, loyal and stuff like that. But now without his one ring, he probably feels like he needs to have an extra safeguard to control his ring rates. And so wearing these 9 rings at all times and not taking them off would ensure that, I suppose. So
yeah,
we could assume that Sauron would wear them in this way, given the assumption that he is not above fear, which is also stated several times by Gandalf. And one of his fears certainly would be treachery by one of his deputies, especially the higher ranking ones. And he would never have to fear treachery from the ring rates if he has complete control over them, like in the situation, controlling, like having their rings, the only thing that they actually have any desire for, he has them, and that can put even more control on top of them. Now, we also, one final note would be that we get a quote from Galadriel in the chapter, The Mirror of Galadriel, and it is, "You saw the eye of him that holds the 7 and the 9." So there, Galadriel seems to say that Sauron is the one who holds the 7 and the 9.
Hmm. Yeah. So, but that would have been past tense, right? Because he doesn't have the 7. Oh, he does have the 7. Oh, yeah. He reclaimed all the 7. Oh, yeah. Very interesting. Very astute observation there.
Now, I wouldn't say he holds the 7 because maybe I think 4 of them have been destroyed by that point. So he held the final 3 of the 7.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
But still quite astute of Galadriel to say that, look, whatever ones have left are left to 7, he holds them, and he probably holds the 9 as well. So
he holds them in high regard. Maybe that's what she meant.
Exactly.
Also, what the hell? Why is who's Tolkien writing all these letters to? I really want to know.
I don't know.
Like, why is it always like, well, he says this in the book, but in 4 letters that he wrote to randomers,
it's more like letters to publishers and things like that.
Maybe, yeah. But it kind of reminds me of the olden day version of J.K. Rowling's tweets.
Maybe. Ah, well, they're still good. They're still valid.
They're still good.
The 9 have left Minas Morgul.
The 9.
So then, do you know how the rings were destroyed, or how did we come to the end of these 9 rings, Dave?
Mordor lava, the Mount Doom, basically, when it erupted.
It's a good guess, yep.
Yeah, sucked everything in. And the lava from Mount Doom.
Basically, yeah. So again, when Mordor was destroyed, or when the One Ring was destroyed, it caused an eruption of Mount Doom, and that just, the fires basically wiped out everything.
But even if they weren't destroyed, they would have been made redundant anyways without the power of the One Ring.
That's true. That's true as well. Yeah. So very good. Well done. Good job. Mm. And so also, we should also note that I think that in those fires, the Palantir that Sauron had was also destroyed. So these were kind of really powerful and important artifacts. So they were all just, you know, destroyed in the fires of Mount Doom. So
and
there
evil
you go.
As well. Mm, yeah,
evil
very
was
good.
Destroyed.
Jeez, all the Palantir
of Sauron is washing away. And Sauron.
What was I going to say? All the Palantiri, like they also just like got lost into history, unfortunately. Like no artifact seemed to.
I mean, Aragorn still has his one, so he's just like chilling with his Balandian.
Yeah, wonder what
he's gonna know what to call. It's like having FaceTime and just like being the first person with an iPhone and be like, who do I call on FaceTime?
Yeah, imagine like Bill Gates, and he was just like, is it Bill Gates? Yeah, Bill Gates, and no, who the hell created the iPhone? Steve Jobs.
Imagine Alexander Graham Bell.
Steve Jobs invented the phone. No, but when he invented the iPhone, he's like, how do I test it? I can't ring. Or, you know, like iMessage. He's like, how do I test this? There's no one else that has an iPhone.
Oh, man. Class. Steve. So, powers of the Nazgul, Dave. Want to hear about their powers?
No.
Not at all. No. Why would you shoot it? Okay. So, I'm going to read a little bit here from the website, lotr.fandom.com. And reading about the Nazgul, it says the Nazgul were sustained by the power of Sauron. The Witch King in particular was difficult to slay, for any weapon that struck him would be destroyed. The Nazgul's own weapons included long swords of steel, and some, at least two, carried Morgul blades. Their leader possessed a powerful black mace as well. Their arsenal of deadly armaments was not confined to physical means. They also had powerful voices which brought terror into the hearts of mortals and a general aura of dread. They wore hauberks of silver mail and had enhanced senses of hearing and smell. So the Nine could not see during the day as mortals. Instead, they saw shadowy forms. At night, they saw shapes and forms invisible to mortal eyes. They were to be feared they were to be feared the most at that time during the night. And they sensed the presence of the ring at all times and were drawn to it, especially if it was put on a finger. They were also surrounded by an aura of terror, which affected all living creatures. The Black Breath, also known as the Black Shadow, was a serious and often fatal condition resulting from contact with a Nazgul. Do you know of anyone who we know who was affected by the Black Breath?
The Black Breath? Is that literally, what, if you touch a Nazgul, is it?
If you come in contact with a Nazgul, now it sounds like if he speaks to you and he says something, he can put you under a spell, but I think you can be, just if you're in his vicinity, like if you're, like kind of COVID, like don't come into within 2 meters of the Nazgul.
Wear a mask whenever you're near a Nazgul. Like.
Special black mask.
Well, I would imagine Eowyn?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And
cool.
Who
yeah.
Else, basically,
Theoden.
Eowyn then gets saved by whom?
Aragorn.
Wait. Who else does Aragorn save?
Oh.
At that same time.
Mary. Saves. Oh yeah, Mary.
Correct. Yeah. Well,
yeah. 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 Oh, so when Mary stabs him,
because there were three.
Three. Is it part of that? Did Aragorn save this person too?
Yeah, Aragorn saved three people after the battle.
Faramir?
Yes, well done. Yeah. Good job. Three for three. Very good. Well done. Nice. So these three people came in contact with Nazgul, and they were all put under this black breath condition. And
gross.
Aragorn had to, sounds like proper stinky breath. Like,
he just hasn't brushed his teeth for thousands of years.
Whenever I develop a disease. Yeah,
whenever
I watch the third movie, I always think that the mouth of Sauron, I'm like, his breath must be absolutely rank. But like, if the Nazgul actually had like, they had their own name for it, like the Black Breath. It's like,
yeah, geez, but like,
must have been awful.
Yeah, I suppose like the black the Nazgul, their entire face is just like a hole, do you know when you get like a hole in your tooth because it's so infected and disgusting and you need to get it filled in? Well, the whole Nazgul's face is just a hole. So that's
needs
how
to
bad.
Be filled in.
Exactly.
Yeah. They go so to the desk, like, you need a giant filling to fill all this
You
hole.
Need a huge face.
That's the black breath. Stinky breath. Gross. That the Nazgul had, that basically could be fatal. And Aragorn, who was the king and he had the hands of the healer, which was like a... what do you call it? A prophecy. There was a prophecy that said something like, the hands of the king are the hands of a healer, and he who heals, la la la, so the king shall be known, or whatever. So
a doctor.
Aragorn, so Aragorn basically was a doctor, and they were like, you're a doctor, you must be king. So that was the Black Breath. Now, the fear that the Nine inspired was one of their greatest strengths, according to Gandalf. And also, Gandalf said that if Sauron regained the One, then they would become vastly more powerful. But he didn't really specify how. That's just Gandalf. He was just, however, as Sauron's strength grew in the course of the Lord of the Rings, the Nazgul did become more powerful, which we see in the movies as well. And in the Fellowship of the Ring, their cries were simply unnerving to the hobbits, and they appeared to be physically weak a bit as well, as Aragorn managed to hold them off, five of them at least, single-handedly at Weathertop. But in The Return of the King, however, their cries are powerful enough to send all but the most stout-hearted of Gondor's defenders into helpless terror. And the Witch King in particular had become so powerful that he challenged the reborn Gandalf the White. And some of them, or all of them, maybe even practiced sorcery using spells for wicked purposes. And the Witch King in particular, I remember he's casting spells on the door of Gondor, as of Minas Tirith, as Grond is breaking it down. And it's kind of like the combination of Grond and his spell that actually destroys that door. So they had some other little powers like that as well. But
yeah,
it's kind of cool. I think we spoke about that as well a long time ago in a different episode, of how the Witch King, when he finally challenges like Gandalf, that's when he's at his most powerful moment. Sauron's power is increasing, and so the Witch King's power is increasing.
Yeah.
So they are kind of like just getting stronger and stronger all the time throughout the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, so like a dyad in the Force, a little bit.
So then, speaking of a couple of weaknesses, on the other hand, so one of their weaknesses was just daylight itself, like bummer. So with the exception of the Witch King of Angmar, none of them, especially Gamul, could operate as well under the sun, and they generally feared it. At Weathertop, Aragorn used fire to drive the ringwraiths away from Frodo, and even the Witch King was afraid of fire. So we see at the Ford of Brunnen, Aragorn and the hobbits that accompanied Frodo used it to assist Glorfindel and drive the ringwraiths into the waters. And that's where we see that in The Lord of the Rings, it's with Arwen. In the books, we know it's Glorfindel, but they kind of use fire to push them into the water. It's not just Arwen's like, if you want him, come and claim him. It's a little bit different in the book, but they kind of use fire to push them into the water. And if an enemy was strong enough to resist them, their kind of aura of dread, if they were able to kind of resist that aura of dread, then the ringwraiths kind of just lost their power. They didn't really have any power if nobody feared them, kind of exception of the Witch King. He still had other powers, but basically if you didn't fear them, you were almost like resilient to whatever. So some heroes of Middle-earth, such as Aragorn, Gandalf, and Glorfindel, could single-handedly face a ringwraith and defeat or at least elude them, provided they were not confronted by multiple ringwraiths at the same time or the Witch King. However, only a few could resist them all at the same time, such as Gandalf. He resisted the Nine at the same time, and Glorfindel was in fact able to instill fear in the hearts of the Nazgul, which is pretty
Jesus.
Cool. He was.
What did he do? Let out a huge scream himself. That's interesting, though. Like the way that you said, if you don't like fear the Nazgul, they kind of lose all their power. Kind of reminds me of Santa Claus in the Elf movie. Do you know, if you don't believe in Santa Claus, then he doesn't have enough power to power his sleigh. It's like if you don't believe in it, his magic doesn't work. And that's exactly what the Nazgul, the same effect they have as well.
Mm.
So
sorry, that's hilarious. I was just thinking of seasons don't fear the Nazgul or the Reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. Do, 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 do. So come on, baby. Don't fear the Nazgul. That could be a version of the song that we could do.
That's their theme tune, is it? When the Nazgul come riding into town.
That's the theme of like the Fellowship. But they're like, don't fear the Nazgul. that would be class. And you can get Will Ferrell in there with more cowbell and all that kind of stuff. You know.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so when the Nazgul traveled separately, and especially during the day, that's when they were at their weakest. And also when they were the further they were from Sauron, the weaker they were also in most cases. So basically then...
Sound like Treebeard there. The further they are from Sauron, the weaker they are from Harm. Or no, it was a Pippin, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Treebeard's like, well, that doesn't sound very smart to me or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway,
make much sense to me. Then again, you are very small.
I love how he says that. I thought he was going to say, like, but then again, you have been right before or something.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. The only reason you're like, very clever.
You're very small. And that's like the only thing you've got going for you.
Yeah, I love that quote. It's so good.
So when they're separated, they're weaker. And when they're further from Sauron, they are weaker as well. So then on the contrary, when they're joined together and when they're close to Sauron and when Sauron is at his strongest, that's when they are the most powerful as well.
Like Power Rangers, yeah.
Yeah, they basically join together and they, you know.
What's that thing that they say? What do they say? Like, amalgamate, but they don't say that. They say, like, morphin time. I can't remember what they say.
I think it's more morphin time rather than amalgamation.
Amalgamate time. No, what do they say? Ah, this got out of my head. Don't they say something?
Is it morphin time? I think you're right with that.
Morphin time? Is that Power Rangers? Yeah, is it? Yeah, maybe it is. Morphin
Mighty
time.
Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Isn't that...
Okay, yeah, yeah. It's Morphin time.
Yeah. Who's Morphin? What was it?
The Morphin Man?
The Morphine Man. He just goes around delivering morphine. Especially if people are suffering from the Black Breath. He's like, yeah. You need some morphine. Moving on to when they actually attacked Frodo at Weathertop. Frodo puts on the ring to hide. And what actually that did was enter the Wraith world where they were just like, aha, hello, how are you? And they were like, we can see you now. We couldn't see you very well before.
We can smell him, but and then he just like pops up. He's like, there he is. Kill him.
It's like, imagine you're in the normal world and Frodo's wearing the ring and he's like, I need to hide it. He takes it off and he just appears and you're like, oh, there he is. So
yeah,
I
mean, exactly.
If he hadn't put it on, it would have been much harder for them to see him well enough to attack. Now they could, during day, they could see, during day and during night, they could see shadows and blurs and stuff, but it just wasn't very clear. But we shouldn't blame Frodo, I suppose. And let's remember how brave he actually was in that instance in the book compared to in the movie. So do you actually remember the differences from the movie or book Frodo in that moment, Dave?
In that moment? Oh God, what the hell?
So why did the Nazgul run away at Weathertop?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, you definitely know this.
I know.
It's deep it's and buried in there somewhere. In that big, thick brain of yours.
But I haven't delved too greasy or deep enough.
You don't delve into your own brain that often, actually.
No, I don't.
I'll delve into your brain for you. So basically,
okey-doke.
The Nazgul, by their nature, were dismayed by fire. And Aragorn, of course, arrives at Weathertop, dual-wielding flaming torches. He doesn't have a sword in the book. He just has two like fire sticks. So that's obviously one of the first reasons. I'll get on to other reasons in a moment. But basically...
Does Frodo shout some name that scares them?
He does. Yes. Exactly. Ah. Well done. And okay. You've missed your chance now. I'll come back to you. In The Fellowship of the Ring, in the chapter A Knife in the Dark, Aragorn says, quote, Sauron can put fire to his evil uses, as he can all things. But these riders do not love it and fear those who wield it. Fire is our friend in the wilderness. And then later on, there's another quote from the same chapter which says, Frodo, they're speaking about, even as he swooned, he caught, as through a swirling mist, a glimpse of Strider leaping out of the darkness with a flaming brand of wood in either hand. So that's our quote telling us that in either hand he had a flaming brand of wood. So he didn't have a sword at this time. His sword that he carried was broken because he carried around the shards of Narsil. And so he just jumped out with two fire sticks. He started like fighting the Nazgul with the two sticks of fire, which is pretty deadly as well. Now, that's obviously one of the reasons why the Nazgul would have got scared. But going on to the second reason, there was the reason of an enchanted blade. Does that ring a bell, Dave?
Are we not talking about the Morgul blade?
Frodo's enchanted blade?
Oh, right. The one that he would have gotten at a, at the, what the hell are they called?
Barrow?
The Barrow Whites, yeah. Or he got it at the Barrow Downs, and they were special enchanted blades that were created for actually killing and harming the Witch King.
Yep. And correct. Well,
just the Witch King, right? Not the rest of the Nazgul. Yeah, because they were from the battles of Angmar.
So. Exactly, yeah. I mean, for like to kill the Witch King, but I'm assuming they probably would have done damage to all of the Bais. You know,
all the lads.
All the lads definitely would have been like, oh crap.
The entourage.
I know that sword. So yeah. Basically, we also, yeah, we've seen this before, that in the movie, Aragorn just throws them four random little like hobbit-sized blades. But in the book, they actually short blades. They got these daggers from Tom Bombadil when he saved them in the Barrow Downs. And there was a thing called a Barrow White, which is basically kind of like a Nazgul type of creature.
Similar, yeah.
Lived in this little like, kind of cave and called the Barrow Downs. And he basically dragged the four hobbits in there and
freakier. They're definitely freakier than the Nazgul.
I don't know. We just don't know anything about them.
But the way they were having this like ritualistic like murder, it's kind of spooky.
Yeah. They're like Nazgul, but with a fetish.
Yeah. And they like go out and drug hobbits and like drag them back to their cave in their white van.
And they dress them up in little like white cloaks and they put rings on their fingers and all that kind of stuff. And then they kind of, they lay them down. They put a sword across all their necks and just kind of lay them there. And then Frodo kind of came too. Now, Frodo was the hero in that situation again, where he woke up, he kind of got like, came out of that like spell and he called for help to Tom Bombadil. And then Tom Bombadil came along, saved them all.
And sang a song,
of course, as he did. And then he found these blades that had been created for the purpose of harming the Witch King specifically, and just the Nazgul would have hurt any of them. And he gave them to all the hobbits. And so that's the reason... Merry's blade does damage to the Witch King before Éowyn stabs him.
When he stabs him in the knee.
And that's also the reason that when Frodo took out this sword, the Nazgul recognized it. And they said, oh, shite. He's got a pretty powerful sword that could definitely do us harm. So basically, that's one thing that the Nazgul didn't expect to see when Frodo just pulled out that sword. Now, also, Frodo...
Is this after he gets stabbed as well?
No, it's before he gets stabbed. So I'm just going to... Okay. I think I have a quote here somewhere that I've kind of lost. But basically...
Lost!
where am I? I'm over here somewhere. So in the film, Frodo drops his sword and falls to the ground like a pussy. And the Nazgul like just come up and grab the ring, basically. But in the book, he was no pushover. And he does still put on the ring, but... he has this enchanted blade in his hand. And there's a quote here where it's from, again, the same chapter, A Knife in the Dark, which was, at that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground and he heard himself crying, "O Eleberth Gilthonil." At the same time, he struck at the feet of his enemy. So he actually struck at the feet of his enemy. And I think it says that he hit them in the foot with this blade, which could be seriously damaging for them. But he also shouts this name, "O Elbereth Gilthoniel." So who was this Elbereth Gilthoniel character? So this was the queen of the Valar and the kindler of the stars. And in light was her power and her joy, long before the original Dark Lord Morgoth had hated her and feared her more than other of the Valar. And of all the Valar who dwell in the world, the elves held her most in reverence and love, and they called upon her out of the shadows of Middle-earth. So
cool.
After the attack, Aragorn searched the area and found a slashed black cloak. And in the next chapter of The Flight to the Ford, there's a quote that says, "The only hurt that it did to his enemy, I fear, for it is unharmed, but all blades perish that pierced that dreadful king. More deadly to him was the name of Elbereth."
Okay, so
basically,
cool, yeah.
Aragorn saying that the name of Elbereth was more damaging to the Nazgul rather than even hitting him with this sword, even though that sword had been designed to kind of hurt him.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't make probably contact. I think maybe just
you said it was
maybe chopped his nail.
Gave him a little pedicure. It's probably because did you say that was the queen of the Valar and she had like light power? So it's obviously because they fear the sun and the moon.
They fear light and they fear daylight. And
yeah, so it's almost like casting a spell of light against them and just like calling out the name weakens them. We've said it so many times on this podcast before, but names of people are very important in Tolkien's world, and like just calling out someone's name can be a very powerful almost spell.
Yeah, the spoken word.
Yeah. Exactly. And we've said it before how like sometimes these names just like come to Frodo, and like did Frodo know who Elbereth was, or did he hear of it before? I think it just like came out of his mouth, and it was just like, oh, where did this come from?
Exactly. And in that quote, again, I'll just read it again very quickly, because there is a few times in the book that it says things like this. It says, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground and he heard himself crying aloud, "Oh, Elbereth Gilthoniel." So it's like he heard himself as if he's kind of like
an outer body experience.
In sort of a passive way. Like, yeah, almost like it's an outer body experience. He's just like, oh my God, who's that speaking? Yeah. Oh, it's me. And it's, it happens a couple of times like that in the book. So
yeah.
It kind of makes it feel like he says it without this kind of power just comes through him. And maybe it's because the Valar are working through him.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
But
that's cool.
So yeah, so then again, the question originally was, why did the Ringwraiths run away and what scared them? Well, basically, the Ringwraiths and the Witch King saw this small little hobbit wielding a powerful ancient sword created for their destruction, and saying the name of an ancient power while in possession of the One Ring. And they were like, hold up, like, what? Who is this guy? Yeah. What's going on? So they got a bit scared.
Yeah, they did get
turned around.
You would get scared. Because like, if it was you and I, and we were just in a normal, you know, a regular fight, as we'd be doing every now and again with swords and whatnot. Like, I know any sword can kill me and any sword can kill you. And like, we accept that and we still choose to fight each other. But like, if you're a Witch King or a Nazgul and you're like, right, there's only like four little blades in this earth that can harm me. And, you know, I've gone thousands of years without seeing them. And then suddenly you see the One Ring and this blade and he's calling out some freaky names. You're going to be like, I'm gonna ditch this scene right now.
Yeah, you're gonna like, well, at least let's just take a step back and regroup for a moment. Plus, it was only five
that's
of them.
True,
so
yeah.
They were like,
didn't have their full force.
Get the other four lads, and you know,
the Witch King wanted to go and get his makeup done as well. Like, he wanted to get the whole gear and armor put on.
Wanted to get his new hat.
Yeah, his new hat and his new big mace.
Could get my special hat for this special occasion.
My Frodo killing hat.
So then obviously there's one other fear that I didn't mention, and that is the fear of water. So we see this a couple of times, obviously, in the Fellowship of the Ring. One, when we see Arwen, which is maybe not accurate to the book, but we see them in the water and then they get, you know, drowned by the big waves and stuff. So that is accurate to the book, the part of getting drowned. Maybe just the only thing that's different is it's not Arwen, it's Glorfindel. And then we also see at Buckleberry Ferry that the hobbits jump on and then the Nazgul is like
reluctant to go after him,
really quick stop, and he like, you know, he slams on the brakes on his horse and he's like okay, and so what's that about? Why are they afraid of water?
I always just kind of thought it was because water is so natural and it seems like it's very, I don't know, entwined with like everything that elves give off and like that kind of I don't know, I could be stabbing in a completely wrong direction here, but
miles off.
Well, I think the reason that they don't like fire is because of obvious reasons. It can like burn them up, and there's also loads of light in fire and they don't like light. But water, I don't know, for me water is like
it's too living.
Yeah, it's like it gives us life, and it's like they probably don't need water to survive. And it's just a representation of like the Valar's gift of life to humanity.
Right, okay.
So tell me the actual answer.
big load of bull you just spieled out there, but I like it. And some of it ties in a little bit with actually...
Correct answer.
But no, that's not a bad... Now, when you mentioned the Valar, there is one Valar.
Ulmo.
We'll get to... That's correct. Well done, Ulmo, who was basically like Poseidon.
Yeah. He was Poseidon himself.
I was about to say the same thing, but I was like, that's too bad. Don't say that. That's terrible.
I almost said it. Okay. We'll stop.
Okay. So in the Unfinished Tales, Christopher Tolkien wrote a passage concerning the fear of water. And he says, "All except the Witch King were apt to stray when alone by daylight. And all again, save the Witch King, feared water and were unwilling, except in dire need, to enter it or to cross streams unless dry-shod by a bridge. At the ford of Brunin, Only the Witch King and two others with the lure of the ring straight in front of them had dared to enter the river. The others were driven into it by Glorfindel and Aragorn.
Okay, cool.
So they were driven in by the fire and by the two of those guys. And then later on, he says, "My father nowhere explained the Ringwraith's fear of water. It's made a chief motive in Sauron's assault on Osgiliath, and it reappears in detailed notes on the movements of the Black Riders in the Shire. Thus, of the riders seen on the far side of Bucklebury Ferry, just after the hobbits had crossed, it is said that he was well aware that the ring had crossed the river, but the river was a barrier to his sense of its movement, and that the Nazgul would not touch the elvish waters of Barad Dûn. My father did indeed note that the idea was difficult to sustain." So you see that in a few places as well, where people say that basically Tolkien later on, he was kind of going, it's difficult to kind of sustain this idea that they had a fear of water, but he definitely assumed that they did have a fear. Now, this kind of confirms that they definitely avoided the water out of fear, and that their fear was not related to their horses, like the horses drowning, but it was actually deeper than that. So now the Silmarillion states that all water is under the control of Ulmo, as you said, the second most powerful of the Valar. So Ulmo is the Lord of Waters. He is alone. He dwells nowhere long, but moves as he will in all the deep waters about the earth or under the earth. He is next in might to Manwë, and before Valinor was made, he was closest to him in friendship, to Manwë that is. For all seas, lakes, rivers, fountains, and springs are in his government, so that the elves say that the spirit of Ulmo runs in all the veins of the world. So that's just a quote there. So basically, yeah, like you said, kind of, well, Ulmo is just this kind of living Vala who still lives in Middle-earth and in Varda by just water. All water is like kind of, he has, you know, he has his senses in that. So
yeah,
it's kind of like there is a living Vala just in all water in Middle-earth. So when you said that, then that's
that. Quite, I think that's what I was scratching
quite
at.
Quite
there,
on the money there. Yeah, it's pretty good. You just, you didn't know what you were saying.
I know.
But you were like, I reckon they don't like water because of something to do with a Vala.
I just heard myself saying it. I had an outer body experience and I was like, Elbereth, Ulmo.
You were just shouting Elbereth there.
Elbereth.
Yeah, your eyes went white and you started like chanting stuff. So in. Next question, Dave, is how exactly did the Ringwraiths get back to Mordor after they lost their horses in the ford? And like, so they lost all their horses.
Yeah.
They were fairly whacked up. Did they just like, did they hitch? Did they walk? Did they get the bus? How did they get back?
They're banned from the Eagle service anyways. I know that for a fact. So they couldn't get a taxi to Mordor. I don't know. I'm wondering, did they get their fell beasts in this time? Or I don't know the answer, but is that the answer? Did they happen to find their fell beasts before getting to Mordor?
No. Okay. They got their fell beasts very shortly after this.
Right. I mean, but they did get back to Mordor first?
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of. We don't, we'll see. Well, definitely one of them got back to Mordor. Guess who?
Witch King?
Of course. Yeah. Isn't that like was, you know, the main one that had to do anything, it was going to be the Witch King. Now, so the Wraiths were once basically humans, so they didn't gain high magic qualities after they became Wraiths. Like, they didn't gain the ability to suddenly fly or anything crazy like that. So as humans, they could, you know, wear clothes and wield weapons and ride horses and talk to people. And without their horses, they simply had to walk on their feet. And
could they not just get another horse, no?
No, because the horses that they rode were bred in the service of Mordor and they were the only horses that would tolerate them. So they couldn't get more.
Because they're stinky the horses, breath.
They're a stinky breath, and just the horses would have just passed out from fear of just, you know, horrible things. Do you remember the dog that we see in Peter Jackson's version?
Yeah,
he's
kind
of like shrieks back. He's like, oh my God. So that's how any kind of animal, any living thing would have reacted to that as well.
Yeah, okay.
Now, so it took them months to kind of get back because they had to walk, but only the bodies of 8 horses were discovered, and also the cloak of the captain was discovered, the captain being the Witch King. And so it is probable that the captain took one of the horses that remained and rode it invisibly as swift as he could back to Mordor.
Huh.
Why do I mean invisibly? Because he didn't have his cloak. And so
he was naked.
The Nazgul, well, I mean, they are basically just naked under clothes, but they're completely invisible. Well, I mean, they're not. I mean, are they naked? Are they not? I don't know. They live in a different realm.
Yeah, so I know. But like, they're naked to me. It's like when they take their clothes, their cloak off. It's like, oh my god, there's a naked Nazgul just running around the place.
It's like it's like in South Park when Cartman thought that he was naked when he took his clothes off, and then have you ever seen that one?
No.
Oh, it's so funny. And he's just sort of like, he thinks that he's naked when he's got no clothes on. So,
do you mean invisible? Perspective. He thinks he's naked when he's got no clothes on. Of course he's naked.
Oh, God. Well, he is. Yeah. He thinks when he's naked, he's invisible.
All right. Okay.
And so there's those things done, like shot from his perspective, and he's naked, and people are, you know, there's like the adults kind of going, oh my God, where did he go? And all this. He's like, oh my God, I'm invisible. And then there's this one scene where there's like the town hall is having a meeting or something. And he just like while somebody is like speaking into the microphone, you just see a naked Cartman just like kind of like moving like in this sort of like a, almost like an Egyptian kind of dance, like a sideways thing across the stage. He's like, no one can see me. And they're all just like looking at this fat naked kid just walking across the stage. They're like, what are you doing? And, yep, so that's basically
the Nazgul,
how the Nazgul did it.
That's the Witch King there.
There you go. Little tangent there for Cartman. But anyway.
That's me! I have to get the first one, else people won't think I'm key!
All right, let's go.
Sweet. Let's get back to it. So, that's what happened. Well, that's a possibility of what could have happened. The Witch King could have grabbed the remaining horse, which hadn't died, and come out and then rode that back to Mordor. And it took him around a month to ride from there back to Mordor. And then the other 8 would have been rescued before they reached Mordor. They would have like maybe had help sent out to them, maybe more horses, or maybe even their fell beasts. We're not sure, because we know that they were attacked in October, and by the end of that year, we know that they were on their fell beasts. So it didn't take them long to get their fell beasts. So that's how they were saved by that.
And
so
did their beasts fell?
Oh, their beasts did fell.
They did fell. He fell.
Very fell beast.
That's how Gimli described the dragons. Yeah. Like, and what did they look like? They fell.
Yeah. Oh, they so fell.
Oh, they so fell.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, very good.
So that's all about the Nazgul and the Nine.
Yeah, very good. I'm surprised you managed to get as much information as you did, because I did remember, I think I might have ages ago thought I might look up or start researching on the Nazgul and see like who they were before they became the Nazgul. And then fairly quickly I was like, oh wait, there is no information. So dropped that idea a long time ago. But we still managed.
Took me a while to flick through a few notes and to go into the deep archives of the internet.
Mm. But I did remember that Camul the Easterling guy, and I was like, oh, that is cool, because it does mention that the rings are given to 9 kings of men, right? They're all kings, or kings and lords, or whatever.
Yeah, it kind of, like, it's not very clear, but we assume that they're kings, or else they're just rulers, or maybe, I don't know,
You said 3.
Go back and listen to the start of the podcast.
three of them are Numenorean. That's what you said.
Yep.
That's interesting. That is correct. And I wonder, are they going to touch on that at all in the show? Because this upcoming show, we know that they're going to be doing a lot of like non-lore things or non-canonical things, but like where I want to see them like invent their own story is where things aren't specifically mentioned, or things aren't set in stone.
Of course. So like we don't want to see canon change, but we do want to see, like, you know, where there's room to like fill in some of the gaps.
Exactly.
They could do that.
It's heavily assumed that they're going to do something with the Blue Wizards. Well, I think they are anyways. But another thing
I'd be all for it.
Yeah. And another thing could be some of the Nazgul, especially if some of them are Numenorean, and that would be so cool to see how they ended up.
It would be very cool. Very cool to see some like long character development and like a big arc, and then eventually being like at the end of like when he's starting to like, you know, look like lust for power, you just see Sauron be like, here, take this ring. That'd be class.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's
very good.
That's it for another episode.
I didn't think it would end this way.
End? No, the journey doesn't end here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it for another episode of The Council of Elrond. We hope you enjoyed that and learned a few things about the Nazgul or the Ringwraiths and about their nine rings. So next up will be an episode dedicated to the One Ring, so make sure you are subscribed and you have your notifications turned on so that you don't miss that one. Thank you, as always, to our patrons, our subscribers, our listeners and viewers. It means the world to Dave and I that we can be a part of your week and hopefully put a smile on your face while imparting some geekly knowledge. There's nothing stopping us now, and new episodes and videos will be coming quick and fast. But even so, don't be hasty. See you next time.
Goodbye.